If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Micro Brew, Milwaukee Brewers Chatter from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It is not often that we have just one game to discuss when we perform this here podcast, but that is the case right now. The Brewers defeat the Chicago Cubs in game one of the National League Division Series, 9-3. They score all nine runs in the first two innings, six of those in the first inning. A tremendous debut from the 2025 Milwaukee Brewers, looking good doing it, hitting none of the homers, but hitting a ton of doubles, getting things started right out of the gate, and then doing enough to hold off the Cubs. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the show. Kurt Hogue, Brewers beat reporter, who is there with me at American Family Field, taking it all in. He's on the other line. And Kurt, I don't know if we'll go the normal length here, but we still have a lot of interesting stuff to discuss from game one. I love how Jesse Rogers, who is a ESPN reporter, covers the Cubs a lot. I love how he put it, that the Brewers were shot out of a cannon to start the 2025 postseason. They give up a leadoff home run, which you called, by the way, to Michael Busch. And then the Brewers end up scoring six runs in the bottom half. Matthew Boyd does not make it out of the first inning. Tremendous first outing. And I think we start by talking about, and we'll talk about all the aspects of this. Jackson Chourio is a big storyline, of course, his injury situation. It felt like the break was such a big deal. You know, we talked about how it was a perfect opportunity for this team to get well, 5 days off. And, you know, sometimes there's concern about momentum or whatever, like staying engaged. Well, I mean, Matthew Boyd pitching on short rest clearly did not have it. Gives up a ton of early hits, three pitches, three doubles to the top three guys in the lineup, Jackson Chourio, Bryce Turang, and William Contreras. And the Brewers are off. Boyd, after a really long at-bat with Blake Perkins, doesn't make it out of the first. Questionable decision, I think, to start Matthew Boyd in the first place. But bottom line, this team looked completely locked in right out of the gate. And I feel like there's just no other way to say it, that break was everything they needed. And the question now is, can they sustain it? That's it. It's been really nice that they've gotten these breaks here for a team that's been a little banged up.
Yeah, I mean, going into the break, we said, like, it doesn't really matter that they've kind of stunk for a little bit here. The question is not, like, are they going into this playing poorly? Are they going into this playing great? It's do they have what it takes to do this another 10 times? We will continue to answer that wonderful question on this journey that we are going on together, you, me, the listeners, and Bryce.
If they could stay awake, 8 o'clock, 8:08 p.m. on a Monday night, that's too late for people like me. That's tough.
Well, it better not be too late for people like you, because
I'll be there.
Your bald self will be seated to my left.
Will I be sleeping in the press box? People want to know.
Will I predict any more home runs?
You were on fire.
However, on fire. It did not stop there.
You did, in fact, call Michael Busch's home run leading off the game. You said, are you ready, JR, for this Michael Busch leadoff home run? You then said at the end of the first inning, it's okay. The Brewers are going to get it right back here in the bottom of the first. You were correct about that as well.
I don't know how I saw that one. But that's probably it for me for the playoffs. I'm just trying to, this is stolen valor. That's really what it is. I'm just trying to be you.
Yes, I still have the big winner. Now I have hitched my wagon to they're going to the World Series. We'll see if that comes to pass. If it does, I just don't know how I can't retire a legend. That's just how it's going to go. So yes, right out of the gate, and this Blake Perkins at bat, I actually want to talk about that a little bit. It's a 12 pitch at bat or 11. It was an 11 pitch at bat. You know, great story this week from Todd Rosiak, our colleague who wrote about Blake. He really had a long heart-to-heart with Blake Perkins, talking about how his mom died during the season. And his mom was pretty young. This was something that wasn't, she'd been sick. It wasn't necessarily like unexpected in the moment, but this was a big tragedy that happened in the middle of the season for him. And he did leave, and he had a little bit of bereavement leave, but it was like two games before he came back in Cincinnati. And it's been a really rough season for him because of that. And you know, we kind of knew it around the beat that there was something up and that he had lost somebody really close to him. But, you know, he's had to fight through that all season long. And I know Pat Murphy just thinks the world of this guy. I know we think very highly of him. He's a great dude, great, great outfielder. He's a fine offensive option, you know, not special offensively, but has hit the ball very well, like toward the latter stages, maybe while everybody else was kind of tailing off. He's been pretty good. And he comes through with this 11 pitch at bat, and without the 2-run single, Matthew Boyd makes it through the first inning, and maybe he makes it into the second inning, and maybe the results are a little bit different. Matthew Boyd is the type of guy who will settle in. He is a veteran. He's one of those guys that, you know, can probably shake off a bad start. At that point, it's 4-1, and it could be a completely different game. So I really think that at bat is the moment that sticks out, let alone, four runs would have won the game in retrospect, but 6 runs made it feel like, okay, they have completely seized control. It's going to take a meltdown now to lose it. And this is the type of thing we've talked about. There are always heroes in the postseason that you don't see coming. Blake Perkins is a perfect example of that. And I really felt like that at bat was really the essential pivot point that turned this game on its head so early on.
Yeah, I would pick Blake Perkins and Joey Ortiz as my out of the woodwork heroes. Joey Ortiz will get a big bases loaded hit in this postseason.
we were
one pitch away from him coming up with the bases loaded in his first
in the first back. Inning. In the first inning, Kurt, we would have loved that.
That darn Blake Perkins had to work 11 pitches and then drive a single to left. I thought what stood out to me most from Game one was, and this is what I wrote about part of this, was how clearly the Brewers came out trying to flip the script. You got the scouting report on our offense. We don't swing. We have the lowest swing rate in baseball. Oh, your starting pitcher likes to fill the zone with four seamers? Guess what, buddy? We're coming out hacking. And for them to go Churio working a good count, double, Terang first pitch, hang slider, double. William Contreras first pitch, sinker, double. We don't see a lot of that from the Brewers. 3 doubles in a row, that's part of it. But 3 straight swings, we really don't see a ton of that. So I don't expect them to like keep doing that. I would figure they revert back to their normal, see a bunch of pitches, grind out at bats, do the ball strike thing. I would expect to see that more in game two against Imanaga, who's a little more of a north-south nibbler, I guess you could say, like maybe going to try to get you to chase a little more with the fastball up and then down with the splitter. So I think maybe there's going to be a reversion here from the Brewers offense, but what is the next chess move in this series, and not talking about just like what player comes here and which player goes there. It's who breaks from their tendencies. Freddie Peralta also did a great job of that. Him and William Contreras, Michael Busch jumped fourth pitch of the game. They're all fastballs. First 4 pitches, Michael Busch jumps on it. Boom, home run, 1-0. And suddenly Freddie starts to mix it up a lot more. I think his fastball rate finished around 45-ish%.
Really low for him. Really,
really
low.
Really low for him. And he kind of ran out of gas a little bit there at the end, the sixth inning, third time through in a playoff game. He like probably 2+ hours-ish into his start, given the fact that he had 2 really long innings to wait. So very understandable why that would happen and also why the Brewers would keep him out there. But he looked great. And a large part of it was his ability to really mix it up, the right on right changeups. Those Cubs hitters were fooled completely for most of the outing by him. So we'll see which team, which players mix it up, and if it works too, because you're also sometimes that means like you're going away from your strength.
You pointed this out, that Craig Counsell in his pre-game media availability, I wasn't sure if this is the day of the game or the day before, was kind of asked to compare, you know, basically compare himself to Pat Murphy. Of course, this is one of the prevailing storylines. Craig Counsell and Pat Murphy have worked together for a lot of years. Pat Murphy used to coach him in college, and then they worked together on the Brewers staff for you know, from 2015 to 2023. And he had just mentioned that Pat Murphy basically tells his guys not to swing. Patience is their, you know, is their biggest virtue. And then, like you said, they come out swinging, swinging immediately at these four seamers, worked out to much to their advantage. And you brought that up afterwards. Yeah. I think that maybe got to them a little bit. Like, I think they're like, oh, you think we're just standing there, huh?
Yeah. I mean, there were certainly some players that saw it. There's at least a couple guys in that clubhouse I talked to that were aware of it. Now, this is an interesting quote where, like, normally I think you can take quotes out of context and it becomes something it's not. Mm-hmm. I think this quote, like, it fully needs the context to take it to something that I felt it is. Now, I don't want to make too big of a deal of, like, kind of an offhand, he was being a little, I never know with Craig, like, how much he's being, you know, being joking. And he kind of walks that line sometimes of, like, joking but being serious and critical. It's tough to figure out, so I can't really put myself in the shoes of understanding exactly what he was going for with it. But the context of it was, he made it very clear from the jump that he was not interested. He shot down any question about coming back here, him against Murph, all that stuff. And then sort of on his own started talking a little bit about the Brewers and how they reflect, like, they play like Pat Murphy's style would have them play. They reflect their manager. So there was a follow-up question asked by Steve McGargy of the Associated Press. Good question. He asked, could you, like, elaborate on that? What do you see between the lines that looks like Murphy's style? And here I was thinking Council was going to say something like, well, you know, they're gritty, or they run the bases, they play good defense, or they're just a tough at bat. And his answer was literally, they don't swing. They don't swing because he tells them not to swing. I was like, you could have, it was set up to give a compliment about the other team. And instead you said they don't swing the bat. So it was just a peculiar thing to answer. A peculiar way to answer the question from a guy who is very, very selective with his answers and his words, as we've talked about before on the podcast, JR, is he didn't criticize players.
No,
he does not do that. He's very selective. And it's a pretty good trait to have as a manager, to be able to pick your words wisely. The Brewers manager is kind of going in the exact opposite direction. And for the content, I absolutely love it. But you also understand why Council does it this way. So I don't know. I don't know. I think that's, maybe it's a nothing burger, but I think it's definitely interesting correlation that he said that the Brewers had a week off. And also what's interesting too is Murph, after the win on, like, the game one win, he said that in their talks with the players this week, one of the main messages was, like, don't be afraid to go out there and swing. Don't be afraid to be aggressive. So the Brewers were actually doing the opposite behind the scenes. And I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what their approach is in game two against Imanaga and beyond, because it was, like, Council's not entirely wrong. He wasn't wrong. They do not swing. They have the lowest swing rate in baseball. Part of it's they don't chase, which is a good thing, but you can get away a lot of the time with aggression in the zone.
Yeah. You try to read between the lines a little bit. Obviously the Murphy Council relationship, Craig Council leaving this organization, shockingly, after the 2023 season, that's a huge storyline here. First time these two teams have met in the playoffs, and Craig Council's just never wanted to engage on this front. He just doesn't want to talk
none
about
of
it.
He's not a single ounce of it.
And he's not the only one who doesn't want to talk about it, because Mark Adonazio had some pregame availability, he and Matt Arnold. And you asked that question about Council, and you know, he took issue because you had said that you know, you characterized it, Mark Adonazio's comments previously, as, like, being burned by Council. And he took issue with that. He's like, well, I never said I felt burned or anything. And he said a couple of nice things, but he was short and to the point. Like, he's not, like, moving on. I don't feel like anybody is. I feel like there's some plenty of bad feelings there. And at the very least, it's just a thing people don't want to talk about, which I find a little bit fascinating. I tell you who does want to talk about it, though. the 42,000 fans who attended this game, who were there at game one.
Oh,
they had thoughts. They had one thought in particular. It was the word was boo, and it was loud. It was so loud. This was something I realized immediately. Once I came upstairs, we had some interviews. I came upstairs into the concourses. Plenty of people were already inside the building. And I immediately started looking for Cubs fans and couldn't find them. They were not there. They were just, you know, obviously they were there, but they were not, there was not a Cubs fan for every Brewers fan. It was all kinds of Brewers fans. And then when the game started and the pregame introductions began, you know for sure, it was so many Brewers fans. That was not a normal Cubs Brewers game, a regular season Cubs Brewers game. This was a heavy, heavy Brewers crowd. Thunderous boos for Craig Counsell when he came out onto the line. I mean, the fans have not forgotten. This is the second year of it, and players spoke about it, and they're like, yeah, we're kind of moving on. Basically, is the summary there. Just, you know, we're just doing baseball things. We're not worried about this anymore. But the fans are not forgetting anytime soon, because that is that's some loud boos. That's way up there. You know, the Gary Sheffield was booed for a long time. I don't know if it was as loud as this. So that's The crowd was a big storyline, I felt like. Now, I feel like game two would be under threat of a more egalitarian crowd because, first of all, Cubs fans have had more time to buy tickets at that point with the extra off day. You know, the Cubs only had 24 hours after, you know, 48 hours, I guess, 36, after they had clinched a spot in the DS to get tickets. So, like, you could see that being a little bit late in the game. But I will be curious to see if Brewers fans hold firm. Maybe they wanted to go to game one and are willing to part with their tickets in game two. I don't know, but they were loud and they were present and you could feel it all throughout the game. And what really struck me is after Michael Busch hits that home run that you called, the second batter, the energy was still way high. It did not take away from the energy in that building. People were fired up for the second batter of the game. And that was different. That was something that I guess I maybe, not that I wouldn't have expected it, but like that's pretty much peak baseball pandemonium. And I wasn't sure we would see that. So impressive stuff. I feel like the crowd really turned out. I feel like they were definitely one of the winners of game one.
I think the Brewers like threat to season ticket holders worked. I think that's what it was. Like, you're not going to be able to keep Cubs fans out of the park. You're not going to be able to price them out of the park either on the second hand market, which although maybe they did a little bit of that, and maybe that's why Monday's game two might be a little more Cubs fans. It's impossible to say, but there's just like going to be some cheaper tickets and probably more available because of the start time. But telling season ticket holders, hey, look, you resell your tickets, we're going to know, and you're not going to be able to get pre-sale for any of the rest of this postseason or next year. I would not resell my tickets. I would want that access to be able to, like, part of the whole perk of being a season ticket holder, right, I believe, is this. You can get your seats at your price for whatever playoff games you want, including a possible World Series. I would not want to miss out on that and have to pay whatever I would have to pay on StubHub. So I don't know. If the Brewers kind of figured something out here, game two will probably be a good indicator as well. But it also just strikes me as like, I don't think Brewers, most fans wanted to sell their tickets. I think this is a series in a game people want to be at. It has the juice. It's cinematic. The only other game, Cubs Brewers game, that I can remember in the last couple of years that was clearly pro Brewers. There's been some that I think have been leaned to the Brewers side, but it was Counsell's return. People didn't want to sell their tickets. They wanted to be there to boo him. I don't know if it was as much as they want to boo him this time. They kind of want to watch the Brewers play the Cubs and maybe beat the Cubs. But I think that animosity drives people hanging on to their tickets as well. If that's you, shoot us a note. I'd love to hear from you. I'm curious what the perspective is on if, you know, why you normally would have sold your tickets if you did for this one. Because you're right, it was like came back upstairs after pregame stuff and I was doing the same. I was on Loge looking around like, all right, there's a group of Brewers fans. There's another group of Brewers fans. Now the next one on the escalator should be Cubs. No, another Brewers fan. Okay, now there's a Cubs fan. And then you just there weren't that many, relatively speaking. It reminded me of like a Cardinals game, kind of like how many Cardinals fans.
Totally. And maybe having this extra off day will, you know, make it easier for Brewers fans to not move their tickets. They didn't have to give up their entire weekend. They just, you know, spent their Saturday and now they'll have a night game, a late night game on Monday. You could see Brewers fans being like, I can do both of that. I can do both of those games. We'll see. I am interested to see how things, how it shapes up game two. Obviously 1, 2, and 5, 2 would be the most likely to have people separating with their tickets. If that is something they feel is available to them, should note that, we spoke to a source with the Brewers and said that it's not unusual for them to have those notices on playoff tickets that you are not supposed to resell them, or you could be barred from future pre-sales. It's just something a lot of people didn't notice until now, or maybe it wasn't as prominent or something. I'm not sure. But that definitely was out there. The biggest story though, that unfortunately the biggest, like, gray cloud, I guess, over what is otherwise a great game is what happened to Jackson Chourio. 3 hits in the first 2 innings of this game. Nobody has ever done that before. The third one, an infield single. He easily beat out on his way down to first base. That drove in a run that made it 9-1. And then he had to come out of the game. He came up with a hamstring issue, right hamstring, same hamstring he injured earlier. And he left the game. He was not happy about it. He wasn't moving poorly, but obviously he was bothered by something. He and the Brewers, they gave an update on, well, first of all, Chourio said he was basically taken out as a precaution and he knew he'd be fine. Pat Murphy, completely opposite side, where he felt like it was extremely concerning. The Brewers had a workout on Sunday. You had some video of Jackson Chourio running that you posted to social media. He does not look good. I mean, he's going 50%, but he does not look good. And even though he insists that he's going to be fine, the Brewers right now say the results are inconclusive on his MRI and not sure what's going to happen there. It might be a game time decision. I think it would be kind of crazy of them to play him in game 2, especially with another day off after that before games 3 and 4. B, I would assume it'd be as designated hitter, meaning you'd have to have Christian Yelich in left field. I mean, obviously Isaac Collins can just sub into that spot if Chourio's not in the lineup at all, but I don't know. And C, I mean, has to be a serious question whether or not we will see Jackson Chourio again in this series, let alone the postseason after that. So give me your thoughts on where we're at with Jackson Chourio. It isn't particularly reassuring, but it's not ruled out that, you know, there's nothing final yet.
I wouldn't say he looked not good or looked bad or anything like that. I was standing pretty close to him, pretty close to the trainers as well. I was kind of like in the middle. Put myself in the middle of the action without realizing I did it. Whoops. He was running at 50%. It wasn't like if I'm running at 50%, it's going to be really slow, but like it'll be very clear. I'm like comfortable. He was still laboring a little bit through it, not really even favoring it. Just maybe a little like being a little ginger with the hamstring. It definitely struck me as my first thought was, okay, this guy cannot play the outfield. That is clearly out of the question, probably for this whole series. And that, I think, how you view that answers the rest of it. He's going to be healthy probably enough to DH. Like, he'll probably DH even as soon as tomorrow, maybe. He'll certainly be healthy enough to DH by the end of the series. And then maybe, like, could he run play the outfield by like in NLCS if the Brewers make it, possibly. But the question being, like, okay, do you just fully rest him for this series and then hope you win and then get him healthy and in the field? Is he going to be able to play the field at all? If he doesn't, do you play Christian Yelich in left field? And this is where the questions start to trickle in. My guess would be for now, they go Collins in left field, and they just give Chourio the time off and keep Yelich at DH. That's where my inclination is right now from what the Brewers are saying, what I was seeing. So the good news is this. It's not a serious, serious, serious hamstring injury, or so it appears. Like, you don't run as well as he was running the day after, even if it was only at 50%. Like, he can clearly move it a little bit. If this was a serious strain, it's probably not as bad as the first one. He'll be back. But in what role and what's the the trickle down of that. Like, even try putting Jake Bowers out there. How do they feel about Christian Yelich in the outfield is probably a big question too.
I mean, I don't know why they'd feel terribly about that. He's okay. He's a, as left fielders go, whatever. You could do worse. You know, Jackson Chourio wasn't playing center field in this game. So as a center fielder, he's not maybe, he, you know, doesn't grade out as positively, I think, as he would in a corner. I mean, he's still obviously he's super fast and he can go get it. And with this hamstring injury, you have to subtract that from the equation. Playing him in center feels like it's just a non-starter at that point. So maybe you can find a spot for him in the corner still. You know, when after he came back from his hamstring injury, I think you had said, and it kind of felt like maybe he wasn't quite 100% at any point. He wasn't like quite letting go fully. So with this recurrence, you know, that feels like, well, yeah, because he wasn't maybe 100% to begin with. And I guess for me, if I see him out there, it's just like, it feels like a ticking time bomb. When is it really going to get pulled again? Because, you know, there's something clearly not quite right. And when is he out for good? Or, you know, how much longer can you expect him to go? And they could do whatever they want. I think it would be unwise for them to play him in game two, knowing that you have another off day on, you know, another off day before game three. You can just let him get ready for Wednesday. That gives you like, what was that? 4 days off, three full days off. I feel like that's probably the smartest course of action. You can even have him pinch hit if you need to in a big spot in game two, but, I would expect Isaac Collins is out there. Christian Yelich at DH, like you said, to get things going, and then we'll see from there. But, you know, three hits right out of the gate. He was so good for them in the playoffs last year. It's hard to overstate. You know, he's just, we kind of talked about it a little bit last year. He was just impervious to like that gloom and doom that seemed to befall the Brewers in the postseason. He just rises to that occasion and was already rising to that occasion in this game. And it is tough to see him leave, and very, very concerning for their offense, which needs all the hammers it can get. I think I'm trying to decide what I think the more unlikely thing is, and that is three pitches in a row, Brewers swinging, and the one guy who didn't swing on the first pitch was Jackson Chourio in that group of three, or Nico Horner committing an error, the second baseman who I'm pretty sure is going to win the Gold Glove in the National League over Bryce Terang. He made an error on a Sal Frelick ball, just a soft bloopy ball on the infield that allowed William Contreras to score from second. That was kind of a wild play. All part of this rally that kept things going. Also part of the equation that got Matt Boyd out of that game right away in the first inning. There was just some weird stuff, some wild stuff. Joey Ortiz walking on four consecutive pitches in back-to-back at-bats. Who is walking Joey Ortiz on back-to-back at-bats in four pitches each? And then everybody else in the lineup actually getting a hit. That was a cool performance. I don't know. I'm not gravitating toward a question here. I guess we could talk about what came after, if the six innings of not scoring again poses any sort of concern, if maybe they got the maximum amount out of, well, that team just came off the wild card series. You get a little bump coming out nice and fresh, and now things are back to square one. I don't know if you look at it that way. How do you feel about that?
Well, I mean, I think both teams are now back on the exact same even footing, right, in terms of rest and pitching rest, I guess, specifically. Look, the Cubs, they should have just pitched Ben Brown every inning of this series. I don't know what they were thinking. The Brewers can't hit that guy.
It's true.
He is disgusting. He is filthy. However, everyone else in the league hits Ben Brown, and the Brewers have never come close to doing it. We talked about the decision to start Boyd, kind of shooing it away as like, ah, they're not going to pitch him on 3 days rest, even though it was 58 pitches. I think the Cubs read a little too much into the only 58 pitches. Like, that's still a lot of pitches. And the guy is not used to pitching on 3 days rest. Maybe it had nothing to do with it. But I just don't love, in general, the concept of sending a guy out there on 3 days rest. I've gone in the exact opposite direction on 3 days rest from where I was a few years ago, where it's like, oh, you gotta get your best guy out there. No, he's not your best guy on 3 days. That's not how modern pitchers are. They're just not as good. and they had viable options, and they chose Matt Boyd. Whoops.
I think we thought we were going to see a former Brewers pitcher, Colin Ray, start that game. And just as kind of the last guy standing after three starters had worked already in the wild card series. And instead, we got former Brewer Aaron Civale working 4 1/3 innings without giving up a run. He gives up an inherited run on the Jackson Churio bouncer, the aforementioned infield single that ended up being the end of his day. And then he just kind of quietly went about his business and shut down the Brewers for quite some time. And of course, there's all this stuff about saving the bullpen or whatever. Like, the bottom line is they were down 9-1. They weren't going to throw, you know, Aaron Civale could have given up 7 runs and he was still going to pitch a bunch of innings. And then Ben Brown was going to come in and pitch a bunch of innings. Like, it was just going to be the same guys under any circumstances. But Aaron Civale did the job. Now, we talked to him after the game. He said a lot of stuff, whatever. I mean, and then I tried to ask him a little bit about how he felt about the departure here. Did not want to go there, which totally fair. It's probably a no-win question, quite honestly. It would probably be a no-win situation to try to answer that one. But I did think it was interesting. This is a guy who started the season, who was here until early June. You know, he was here for the first third of the season and didn't want to go to a bullpen role and has been moved exclusively to a bullpen role, but is in the playoffs, is pitching with a very good team, made the postseason roster, which, I mean, in the wild card series, I didn't really scratch my head at that, but like, wow, the DS series, when you need more, you know, more starting, you know, starting pitchers potentially, that's interesting. So he ends up having a really good day. And if he had started, God, it might've been a different outing. It might've been a different world, believe it or not. If Aaron Civale had pitched the majority of this game, I think Craig Counsell overthought this, man. I mean, not because Civale, I agree with Ben Brown or Colin Ray. I just think Matt Boyd wasn't. You said this on the last podcast. Starting him on short rest is probably works to the Brewers' advantage, and it sure did. They looked great, and they got more runs than they needed right out of the gate against him. So, I think Craig Counsell might have screwed that up. I don't know.
Well, it's not just a Counsell decision; like, it is an organizational decision. Like, the Brewers starting Aaron Ashby in Game 2 is an organizational decision. Now, if it backfires, people online are going to scream at the manager. That's how it's going to be. They're going to yell at him for overthinking it by throwing their second best overall pitcher to start the game. Like, as somehow that's bad process. But anyway, it's an organizational decision. I guess I don't have a greater point than that.
Yeah. How do you feel about it? Yell
at the assistant GMs on Twitter. That's what you should do. Not the manager. Because they're all like, this forward thinking idea, you think it's the manager and not the nerds? Let's think about that for a second.
How do you feel about Ashby coming in? Because they've been a little coy about whether it's Priester. We figured Priester would be the guy, maybe Quintana, because they love them some veterans. Ashby, it certainly seems like Priester would come next, that this is just a straight opener. Maybe he goes all of 2 innings, maybe less. I don't know. And then Quinn Priester comes in and does most of the work. How do you feel about it?
I like it. I think it's the right move. I don't love the Priester Cubs matchup because they hit sinkers and cutters really well. Jack Stern, Brewer Fanatic, was giving me that data today. So shout out to Jack. You know all
what
the
up,
numbers.
Jack? We love
what
it.
Up, Jack. Now you would have thought like this is what Robert Gasser's here for, right? But then I'm like, wait a second. Why not just throw your best pitcher right away? Why not throw the better lefty to deal with Bush and Tucker and PCA? Ashby's probably going to pitch in this game anyway. You had an off day yesterday, get the off day the next day. He's used to the workload. Just throw Ashby. So I've come around on it. And I think the Brewers have a wide net of possible ways to navigate this game at their hands. This is going to be a real good playoff test of Pat Murphy. That's what this is going to be. I think there was a couple moments last year where that came up. Pulling Freddie after 4 innings, which I felt at the time was the right move. Pinch hitting for Hoskins when Bauer's homered obviously turned out to be the right move. So there's been a couple of those moments, but nothing quite the scale of this, which is like, you know, a lot of it's not just going to be Murph. Like I just talked about, there's a plan. The front office has gone over this, the pitching coaches as well. But like, ultimately, it's going to be on him to navigate it and know the exact moments to pull guys. And if he needs to deviate from it, how is he going to do that? I'm not sure we'll see Quinn Priester. I think Quinn Priester is available. That's the vibe I'm getting. Priester's available for this game. We'll see if he pitches. Everyone is available, actually, probably. Jose Quintana is probably even available.
So matchup specific, like you said, Priester maybe isn't the best matchup for the Cubs, but does it feel like a little bit of an indictment on, I mean, Priester is so successful. Like, how is he not the clear cut number two guy? Just go to Quinn Priester. He's your next best pitcher after Freddie Peralta.
Because you don't have to, it's not weird. You don't have to play the game. You don't have to play the game like that. That's not the way the Brewers pitching is best, like, utilized or deployed, especially in a five-game series, especially one with these off days. The Brewers are trying to take advantage of these off days as much as possible. And like Priester might pitch. I don't know exactly what the plan is, but there's pockets in there where you could use him for sure. Like the bottom of the order, they got some righties. We saw Nick Mears hit up that spot. That's why Grant Anderson's on the roster, is that pocket at the bottom. So maybe there is a spot for Priester. Maybe Priester follows. I don't think he wouldn't even be the bulk pitcher. He might be part of a bullpen game. But I don't think there's anything wrong with bucking convention and not just throwing your number two starter in game two. We don't usually see teams do this, but I think I like it. Ask me again tomorrow at about this time.
I like putting Ashby out there. 16 pitches in game one plus the day off here. I mean, that's the thing about these days off, is a bullpen game in game two, it works because, you know, everybody gets that rest. They got the rest of the day before. They'll get the rest of the day after. Go ahead. Use all the bullets. They'll still have that extra day of rest built in. The schedule is very kind that way. I guess I just, you know, think, I don't know. Maybe I just talked myself into like 3 and 4 of the times where you really need starters. You need it to be somewhat, you know, at least something resembling a starting pitching performance, because you need those relievers to be pretty fresh for the biggest games of this series. But yeah, maybe tomorrow is just a bullpen day. Maybe that makes some sense. All right, let's can talk a little more about this game. We can go to some of the more granular details. Let's do that here. It's our weekly segment, 3 Up, 3 Down. Let's talk about some extra roster decisions here. Jacob Mizorowski made it, as we suspected he would. Rhys Hoskins did not make it. Brandon Lockridge did. Also something that I think we saw coming and understand. Then a couple of interesting. I really thought DL Hall would make the roster, not because I thought he was the best option, but I didn't think they would trust Robert Gasser over him. But it seems like that was the call. Rob Zastrzyzny also not on the roster, with, like you mentioned, Grant Anderson, kind of one of the reasons he is there. Which of these interests you the most? It's probably Miz, but which of these really,
No, it's you not listening to me.
When did I not listen to you?
DL Hall? Robert Gasser?
Dude, you told me once that you thought DL Hall was going to be nowhere near this roster. That was like 2 months ago, and I believed you then. But like by the very end, I was like, I don't know. I don't know if they're going to do it. DL Hall seems like they just love him too much, but he hadn't pitched. He threw one inning, and it wasn't like he's been effective this year.
What about the Brewers' handling of DL Hall gives off the vibe they love him too much?
I just get a feeling. I get a feeling that they really like him. I mean, I've nothing against him. He's just been not that effective. Like his stuff is just whatever. And Robert Gasser's really dang good. You haven't seen a lot from him. They left Robert Gasser in the minors forever this year because they just weren't ready to use him or something. And then they finally called him up. It's like, well, they called him up too late to really consider him for this roster. But hey, they made a call I would have made. So I like that.
They did. I think they just felt comfortable with Gasser being in this role. I don't know. I would have personally given him some more time up here and not risk burning that option, but whatever. That's not the most important thing right now. The one that surprised me was Grant Anderson for Rob Z. Mm-hmm. it's essentially, it was Robzie would have been on if it was the Cubs or if it was the Padres, because they stack a bunch of lefties and you can kind of, you know, bring him in the fourth inning and really force the hand. Like, oh, you're going to take Gavin Sheets out now? Yeah, you're going to do that? You're going to take Gavin Sheets out now? And they're not going to do it. excuse me. And they've also got, they had like a couple of lefties down there, Cronenworth among them and some other fellow, O'Hearn, whose name eluded me for a second. And with no Laureano, that changed the dynamic and the construction of their lineup a little bit. Anyway, this is not about the Padres. It's about the Cubs. The Cubs have Kelly, Shaw, and Swanson, I think, 7, 8, 9, and whatever order they're in. And so that, I think, is a spot where the Brewers look at and go, okay, this could be Grant Anderson in some spot. Like, he can get a strikeout. He can get a swing and miss. He's got a little length if we need it in extra innings. And ultimately, like, maybe a little more trustworthy against lefties than Rob Z has been against righties. And so the Cubs lineup makes that a little tough. Like, there would be a PCA spot in the fourth or fifth inning. You could go to Rob Z, try to force their hand, but you don't want him to then be facing Swanson next. That's no bueno. So I get it. I was a little surprised by it. I still think maybe you would want that extra lefty, because you've got a plethora of righties, and I don't really know what the situation is going to be what's the Grant Anderson situation really going to be. Now watch, he's going to get some big outs in game two. But that was a call that shocked me a little bit. Not shocked me, but caught me a little off guard. Lockridge over Hoskins, we saw that coming. Miz, we saw coming. We did. Tobias Myers, you can argue it. You could definitely argue it, but Tobias Myers, we saw coming too.
Yeah, Tobias not on the roster. When Jacob Izurowski comes into the game, man, I am going to buckle in my seatbelt, because I we talked about this. Like, he's special. He is special. But he was not good for the majority of his time here in the big leagues, and definitely not after the All-Star break. And I just don't think he's going to come into a game and get outs. But I've been wrong before. I mean, heck, I certainly thought this team not being able to hit home runs would stand in their way. And look, they just scored 9 runs without a single home run. What do I know? What is your number one in three up, three down?
What has been number one? What else happened in this game?
Well, let's see what happened. You had, well, Savali versus Andrew Vaughn, if you want.
I've got something. All right, for my number one, we're going with the Cubs defense, the Nico Hoerner play.
Incredible. It was
jarring, and a good reminder, too, of sometimes these series, just anything can happen. It's the way the ball bounces. That game might play entirely different. You talked about the Perkins at bat changing it. The Hoerner error also completely changes the complexion of that baseball game. The Cubs probably get out of that inning. It's 2-1. Boyd might settle in. Who knows from there? Could be a totally different ball game. And it swung completely on the best defensive second baseman this year in baseball, butchering I don't want to call it an easy play, but a ball that's hit that soft is one that gives off the impression of being easy and should be made 10 times out of 10 in Major League Baseball. And he just completely biffed it, which, for all the talk, especially for me, of the Cubs defense being the ultimate counter in this series, kind of helped them lose a game in a big role in them losing a game.
Yeah, I guess my number two would be what I just said. Andrew Vaughn facing off with Aaron Civale. Loved those moments. Two long fly balls one was at least warning track. The other one, not so much. Warning track adjacent, at least one of them was. Of course, these are two players that were traded for each other. The Cubs were not involved in that trade. It was the Brewers sending Aaron Civale, who asked to be traded, to the White Sox. He did not pitch well with the White Sox. He had an ERA in excess of 5. He was waived. He made 13 starts with the White Sox, and the Cubs picked him up. Of course, the Brewers in that deal got Andrew Vaughn in a deal that will probably go down in history. Well,
I guess there's probably a need for a little more data before you could say this, but as one of the better trades and certainly recent Brewers history where they where a flyer absolutely worked out. Vaughn got the start in game one, which of course made sense. I wonder if Jake Bauer's he won't start against Imanaga, but I wonder if he does get a start in this series. I think probably that could be on the table. Was hoping for a little bit more excitement when the ball popped off his bat the first time. I initially thought maybe you were going to see a home run there. Andrew Vaughn versus Aaron Civale. I don't know if that would have been lost on the fans or not. I think most people would have probably been excited about that. Did not work out. We didn't get it, but still. There's a lot of games left. There's four, could be four more games in this series. Maybe that moment is still coming. What do you got, Kurt? You got another one?
Nick Mears's ninth inning was interesting to me.
Sure was.
He got two lefties out, struck PCA out, hit 90, sat 96, basically. Flipped in some curveballs to lefties. Small thing, but potentially big thing. We talked about where he lands on the trust tree right now, and he's not near the top, but that doesn't mean it's the playoffs. It's this pitching staff. It looks like they might just have one starter. We might have been giving him too much credit. He could get some big innings.
I was just looking, by the way, at the last... I was just looking at games where the team doesn't homer, how often they win and whatnot. And I'm trying to find like a playoff game in which a team... Okay, so wasn't that long ago, 2024 last year, the Dodgers had a game where they did not homer and scored 9 runs and beat the Mets and 9-0. I was trying... Yeah, it's difficult for me to search for the success in a playoff game where the opponent homers 3 times and you don't, but you win the game. I'd be curious to know. It's probably sometime really recently, but I don't know. Freddie Peralta pitched, we talked about him a little bit. He was staked to a lead, and I think that's a really important thing for him. He gets credit for being people sing his praises, how competitive he is, and I'm sure he would have, it's easy to say he would have been fine maybe if it had been a close game, but I feel like with a pitcher like Peralta, the more runs, the merrier, and I thought he's going to dig in for a really long game after giving up that first run on the first batter. He was able to really settle in, as you would expect with that lead. He did give up a second solo home run, but the game was never in doubt. I thought maybe he'd go a little deeper beyond six innings once they got that big lead. He did not make it. He made it 5 2/3, which is still plenty. Got a great ovation from the fans, much deserved. So great outing for Willie Peralta too. For Freddie Peralta, who has pitched out in 6 postseasons. No other Brewers player has done that. He has pitched in 6 different postseasons for the Milwaukee Brewers. I thought Brandon Woodruff would be number 5. That is very much up in the air. And actually, we could talk about that a little bit, whether we think Brandon Woodruff has any shot of appearing in this postseason. But number six for Freddie Peralta is pretty impressive stuff. He was on the team in 2019 and didn't pitch because that was the one game playoff. He just wasn't in that game, that wild card game in Washington. But he's been one of the best pitchers in franchise history, and it's cool that he gets that moment.
Has Woodruff even pitched in 5?
This would have been 5. This would have been 5 if he pitched 5 this year.
So yeah. No one else has more than 4 then.
That's correct. As of right now, that is true. Yes.
Corbin didn't even
pitch. He's in a class by himself.
Corbin didn't pitch in 19 or 20.
That's Corbin correct, because he was hurt in 2019. He wasn't honestly even on the active roster there at the end. He had that disaster season. So yeah, 18, 21. He had a great outing in game 1 in 2021, the game that the Brewers won, I believe, 2-0 against the Braves. That moment in 2021, the last time they were in the division series, which gives me just that little bit of pause. Like, oh, they won game 1, and then what happened? It went south from there. But yeah, it's a very select company that have gotten up there.
Did you see Eric Lauer's outing for the Blue Jays?
Was that today? Was it game 2 or game 1? I didn't see him.
Game 2. Yeah.
Well, he had some run support to work with. So was he part of the group that gave up the 7 runs?
Yes, I think he got one out and gave up like 3 runs.
That's not great. He is not the guy that came in immediately after Treya Savage, who had 11 strikeouts and no hits allowed in 5 1/3. But
The Blue Jays were up 13-0, 12-0, whatever it was. They had the right to. Dalton Varsho, UW-Milwaukee alumnus, Dalton Varsho with four extra base hits, two homers, two doubles, four RBIs. Yes, sir. Four runs score. He had two hits in game one. What a showing for Dalton Varsho so far. The Blue Jays up 2-0 on the Yankees. We had a great one in Seattle and Detroit on Sunday night. So that series is even 1-1. Good stuff. Good baseball.
You don't need me. You don't need to convince me of singing the praises of the Panthers on here. I love my Panthers.
Those are your people. Those are your people.
Shout out BJ Freeman. Hope you're doing well, buddy.
Well,
I'm going to wrap it up.
He's in an NCAA scandal right now. So no, he's not.
I hope he at least won his bets. Okay. William Contreras.
Yes. He looked good.
The hand is not fine, but he's fine. Does that make sense? I feel like it makes sense if you know William Contreras.
I was so heartened by that swing that he put into the left field gap. Almost caught I wouldn't say almost caught. Ian Happ made a dive for it. But like right out of the gate, that's him saying the hand is good. I felt like, or the hand is good enough.
Yeah. I mean, the man is playing through so much right now. His finger is like destroyed. It does not look good. His hand... I don't know how exactly. I don't remember. I should have looked closer for it today or yesterday, but earlier in the week, like there was still you could tell a significant bruise from, where he got hit by a swing. So super tough. We all knew that about him, but toughness doesn't necessarily get you extra base hits, and the Brewers need extra base hits. So. That was a good sign, as was his single, I think, in the second inning.
Yeah, I agree. A couple things we didn't quite mention. Love the camera angles of Craig Counsell in the dugout and on TBS. TBS is this comes up every year, but it's tough when you have spent 162 games with the same announcers, a lot of summer baseball, listening to the same people, and then the playoffs hit and suddenly it's new announcers, new camera angle. Like, what is with the off center home plate thing? What is going on there? And new cameras, new everything, different lighting, a lot going on. But the camera angles of Craig Counsell in the dugout, that's probably not something you'd see on a FanDuel Sports Wisconsin broadcast. So I appreciated those. I think
I don't get it. I don't get how it's the high home camera, right? They're using the high home camera. The same
one would assume.
It's like the same slot from where they shoot the regular season games. But then
honestly, we have to look into this because I honestly don't know how that could be.
It's offset.
Just
put it in the middle of the screen. Put the mound in the middle of the screen. You have the Brewers have the best. I think they have the best camera angle from center field in all of baseball. It's amazing.
I mean, all center field camera angles are good for the most part, but we have to look into this because it feels like they are shooting from a different part of the stadium. What is going on?
No, I think we do need to look at this, but I believe it is the straight on center field, which look, not all home plate cameras are good. There's some really bad ones. Like, actually, Phillies isn't very good in the regular season.
Texas.
Like the Texas, but Texas is at least straight on. It's so
I don't
on.
Mind Texas, but
I don't like how I don't like how high it is. But yeah, at least it's straight on. There's some that are like, Wrigley's is pretty off center. Pittsburgh has a good one, but like Cincinnati's is pretty bad. This is one of the best ones. Why is the three quarters of the screen like the first baseline? How does that? I'm confused.
I don't know. Either someone is trying to reinvent the wheel, or someone is a big fan of the TV show Mr. Robot, where people's faces are in tiny corners of the screen and the rest of the screen is like background, or they just don't have access to the main home camera and they've got their own, and for some reason they're in just a different slot. Whatever's going on in the batter's eye out there, I don't know. We should look into that. One other thing, Salomon Torres was an interesting choice for first ceremonial pitch. He, back in 2008, was the closer. He's in the last year of his career. I think he was like 39 years old at that point. He became a de facto closer for the 2008 team that broke that 26-year drought. Gave a speech during the pep rally after the regular season finale where You've waited 26 years. You will wait no more. Very, very cool. Very sort of inspirational moment, I would say. So cool to see him. That was a nice thing to have him back. We'll see who's doing the same thing on game two, Monday at 8:08 p.m. Central Time. If we are awake to see it, who will throw out that ceremonial first pitch? All right, that's three up, three down. Let's go back in time. I got something where we're going to go back in time here as part of my weekly segment on Brewers history. Here it is. Remember when? Kurt, you're going to love this. 1982 Milwaukee Brewers, baby.
That's the same sound I made this morning at 4:45 a.m. when my child climbed on my face. Congratulations.
Sometimes the 1982 team climbs on your face.
Stay off my face.
That's God. I could never go back. I have middle school children, and that's quite enough. Thank you. We're going to go back to the World Series because why am I thinking about it? Because the Brewers scored six runs in an inning. It was awesome. And in 1982, they did the same thing in game four of the World Series against the St. Louis Cardinals. What a wild inning this was. The seventh inning in game four. They went into it down 5-1. They came out of it up 7-5. They end up winning, holding on for the win, and ended up, of course, tying that series. They won game five, go up 3-2. They went to St. Louis, needing only one win. Everything was great. I don't remember what happened after that, but here's what happened in the seventh inning, down 5-1 at County Stadium. Dave LaPointe, he is dealing, and he is interesting because he was with the Milwaukee Brewers. He was part of the deal that brought Pete Vukovich, Raleigh Fingers, and Ted Simmons to the Milwaukee Brewers prior to the 1981 season. Whitey Herzog, wheeling, dealing Whitey Herzog, got a bunch of guys in that deal, and one of them was Dave LaPointe, and he was awesome in this game. He was really holding the Brewers in check. The one run he allowed was on a double play. Ozzie Smith, this will shock you, made a great play, scooping a ball, stepping on second, throwing to first, allowed a run to score, but could have been a lot worse. And then LaPointe goes into the seventh inning, gets Gorman Thomas to fly out. No problem. First out of the inning is already recorded. And then he probably should have had the second one. No, not probably. He definitely should have. Ben Ogilvy hits a ball to Keith Hernandez, famous for his defense at first base. And he shovels the ball. He actually kind of whips it to LaPointe, who's covering. And LaPointe just drops the ball. Very similar to what Will Vest of the Tigers did in the wild card round, where it was just a sort of sidearm sling to first. It just clanked off his glove down to the ground. And Ben Ogilvy reaches on that error. Don Money then singles. It's first and second. Charlie Moore had a terrible at-bat against LaPointe, who's a left-hander. He's throwing breaking pitches. Charlie Moore was not in this at-bat. He ends up popping out, but it was uncomfortable. So that's the second out, and nothing has scored yet. But then Jim Gantner doubles to right field. There's your first run. Paul Molitor walks against a new guy. Doug Baer is in as a reliever in place of LaPointe. So he is now on base. Robin Yount gets completely fooled. His check swing on a high and tight pitch at his eyes. And it just bounces off his bat into the outfield for a two-run single versus Baer. They bring in Jim Cott. The Cardinals do. Jim Cott, he was in like the second to last year of his career. He's a Hall of Famer now. But this was toward the end of his very long career. And Cecil Cooper hits a bounder. Right up the first base line, right to Keith Hernandez. That's it. That's the inning. Except they called it foul. Keith Hernandez furious. He thought it was a fair ball. It was ruled foul along that baseline. Very next pitch, Cecil Cooper sends it the other way under the glove of Ken Obergefell, and that winds up allowing another run to score. So let's see. We've got so yes. Now we have tied the game. That's the one that ties the game under Obergefell's glove. 5-5. We are. Ted Simmons is at the plate. There's a wild pitch. Jim Cott throws the wild pitch. Whitey Herzog comes marching out and pulls Jim Cott. Middle of the at-bat. We would never see this today. Middle of the at-bat after the wild pitch. And the new guy who comes in, Jeff Lottie, he finishes an intentional walk then to Ted Simmons. So he was so mad that he didn't even want Jim Cott to finish the intentional walk to Ted Simmons. So the new guy checks in and immediately walks Ted Simmons. Gorman is up again. Gorman Thomas, he was the first out of the inning, and he drives an outside pitch to center. Two runs score. The go-ahead runs. It is 7-5. He hustles into second for the double, and the Brewers have a lead. They go in with a 5-1 deficit. They come out with a 7-5 deficit. Ben Ogilvy walked after that, but then Don Money hit a screamer that was caught by Lonnie Smith. So 12 batters come to the plate. Great inning. Obviously, one of actually two other times that the Brewers have scored six runs in an inning in a playoff game. They did it against the Cardinals in 2011 as well. Bob McClure checks in the next inning after Jim Slayton put runners at the corners with one out. and he gets a double play off Willie McGee, very fast runner, but Jim Gantner makes an incredible play to get the double play and keep things where they are. David Green, another player that came over in that trade, in that 1980 trade, late 80 trade, he's on first base. He's doubled off in that situation. McClure finishes the game. Raleigh Fingers was warming up. This is the thing people forget. He was hurt. He pitched hardly at all in September, but he was on the World Series roster. The Brewers never really committed to him being out for the year. So he warms up in the bullpen, presumably to get the ninth inning. And fans are cheering. They see him out there. It's huge. He's been hurt. He's finally ready to pitch, but he felt some discomfort, and he ended up saying he wasn't going to be able to go, and he didn't pitch in that series, and he doesn't even pitch the entire season of 1983. But Raleigh Fingers just still around. That would be a very tough decision these days. Do you keep him on the roster in hopes that your superstar closer is available to pitch? That's it. That's our step back in time in 1982, one of Kurt's favorite things. Now let's close it down the way we do every week, and that is with Kurt's take of the week. Here you go, Kurt Blanche.
Did they have MRIs in 82?
Yeah, I'm sure they did. When was the MRI invented? Let me Google.
Bro was probably like dealing with insane injuries. And it's like, yeah, I have a little discomfort while I'm warming up. I don't think I'll be able to make it. It's like probably on the verge of going out and pitching in the World Series with the literal injury that kept him out the next year. I don't actually know if it was the same injury, but I'm assuming some things about how pitchers and arm injuries were treated in 1982.
So the MRI is invented in the 70s, and by the late 70s, 1977, they're doing, according to my quick Googling, they're doing scans on patients, human patients. I'm going to guess every clubhouse was not fitted with an MRI machine in 1982. I could be wrong, but I bet I'm not. And so, I'm going to guess it was more like, well, how are you feeling today, Raleigh? You want to try it? It's just, yeah. I'm going to guess pitchers pitched all the time. Pete Vukovich throughout this. 1982.
How many things do you think they were taking? Many. Many things were taken.
Many things were taken.
Who is to say?
I'm pretty sure Pete Vukovich won a Cy Young with a torn rotator cuff. I'm not sure the timeline but like, he was hurt, man. They were all hurt.
All right.
Different era. No one was throwing 98, so it didn't really matter. You were crafty. That's how you got through.
That's right. Because Nolan Ryan was throwing 104.
Allegedly.
So I'm told. All right, JR. Here's something, an interesting thing. I don't know if it's good or bad, so maybe it's not really even a take, but just an observation I've made that I think is, I don't know. It's interesting, to, at least to me, is there has obviously never been a villain in Milwaukee Brewers history, the history of the franchise, that has risen to the level that Craig Counsell currently rises. That's for multiple reasons. I think, no, you don't. Who else would get booed like that? David Friesen get booed like that.
No, it's problematic, but the only other thing I could compare it to is Gary Sheffield. And he, you know, famously didn't like it here. Or I shouldn't say didn't like it here. You know, I don't know. It's, you kind of have to go back to that era. And was he wrong? Like, were his teammates treating him poorly? I don't know. I mean, it seems like it was kind of a bit of both, you know, the young player. But he got booed a lot. He got booed pretty ferociously for years and years. I think the council boos rise above it. But that's the only other thing I could think of.
I will stand by what I said. There's never been a larger villain in franchise history than Craig Counsell to the fans. What's interesting is you can't, like, who from the, what comments have you heard, read, seen from the Brewers where anyone says anything? The closest we've gotten is Mark Atanasio saying Counsell has lost the community. And then in this latest press conference saying, like, no, I didn't say that because I was burned. I just said it because he lost the community.
What does that even mean then?
He lost the community. Don't lose the community, JR. That is not the thing you want to lose with the Milwaukee Brewers.
I don't know what you're trying to say here. Are you saying that the players...
I don't have a take. Okay. It's just that it's just interesting to me that, and like, you could there's certainly reasons why you could see that players would be more sympathetic. A, they know a lot of them know the guy. B, they're all kind of, to a degree, mercenaries for hire. they'll just go wherever the money is. And they'll, you know, they're not committed. They're not any more committed to one franchise than any one franchise is committed to them, which is to say not a whole lot. So you can understand where it comes from. I just think it is interesting that given the level of animosity that fans, your entire fan base clearly has over this one guy going to your rival, no one says that it burns them at all, or like there's just nothing along that line. I'm not saying there should be or shouldn't be, just that there isn't. And I don't really know what to compare that to decide if it's normal or odd or peculiar or just what you should expect, because these are baseball players and why would they care where Craig Counsell goes? Like fans would. They're not attached to the Milwaukee Brewers. I don't know. That's what I got. Just thoughts.
I mean, the players, there's a chance they could work for him. You know, like there's a chance they could end up on the Cubs or wherever Craig Counsell ends up managing. You don't want to burn that bridge. These guys haven't been in Milwaukee their whole lives. They've been in Milwaukee for like a year and a half on average, if that.
What if you didn't get along with him? What if you didn't see eye to eye? What if you didn't? I don't know.
Surely yeah. Not so everyone did. I think what you're trying to hint at is you're not hearing much at all. It makes you wonder, like, was he really like that beloved here? And I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there are only 9 guys, 10 if you count Woodruff, who are still here from the Craig Counsell era. There's only 9 dudes on the roster who played for Craig Counsell. That's just 2 years ago. That counts Sal Frelick, who played for him for half a year, you know? So it's, I don't know. I like half these guys have probably like, they don't even know him. So I don't know. I don't think players care. You know, there's so many moving parts. Pat Murphy was here, so it's not like they're, you know, the continuity is there. They're different personalities and different stuff, but like, I don't know. I just think guys play for a million different managers and they kind of just get used to all of them. That's all I got.
But don't you see, I mean, don't you see how much Milwaukee cares?
Yeah, but I just don't know why that would rub off on these guys. Like
there's such a chasm in between that. Yeah, that's fair.
Freddie talked about it. He's like, yeah, kind of laughing about it. He said, you know, like Counsell knows I love him. We had a great relationship, whatever. And, but you know, that's kind of what happens, right? When you know, like he kind of, his implication was more like you leave a franchise. Like, yeah, I guess it's just the game, man. That's just what's going to happen to you. And not that it's like a good or bad or whatever, but like, you know, that's just comes with the territory. So I think that's probably a reasonable stance. Let me shift gears real quick. Do you think Brandon Woodruff pitches at all in this postseason? Let's say the Brewers go to the World Series. You think he pitches ever in this postseason?
That's
a long pause. Real long pause. I think the answer is no.
I think the answer is no. The door was cracked open by the news this week that he's not fully out. But the news is also, well, he's out for the NLCS too, logistically.
Yeah, that's tough.
And so I think I don't think either party wants to rule it out. And we're just going to try to, but that's just so tough. You'd have to roster him before the start of the series. I don't know. That's still pretty quick. That's like 2 weeks away and the guy's not throwing yet. So I'm going to go no.
Same. Not throwing is bad. You know, it's not like he's close or anything. He's not close. So that's not something that just resolves in 2 weeks. All right. So we've got game 2 Monday night at American Family Field. We've got game 3 and 4 back-to-back days in Chicago, Wrigley Field. I think it's a 4:00 game 3 on Wednesday. So there is that extra day off yet again. And then game 5, maybe October 11th. That's Saturday back at AmFam Field. Could be a wild journey here the rest of the way. Man, Seattle won their game tonight. First playoff win since 2001. That 2001 team that had all the wins. They were just far and away the best team in baseball and then didn't even make it out of the ALDS. Extremely tough. But they won tonight. That's fun. I love playoff baseball. It's a good time. And we'll have more of it. Kurt, any last thoughts?
I'm going to bed.
Me too. I'm tired.
That's a good thought.
We got more Brewers baseball to come. Thanks for tuning in, everybody, to this edition of Microbrew. We'll be chatting with you again as soon as possible, probably next week or the end of the series. If we go five, we'll probably catch you again next week, Monday. If it's sooner, maybe sooner. We'll see. So we'll talk to you again very soon. Bye, everybody.